This is Sarah Robinson, host of Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome our listeners as we continue conversations on the art of transformation. I'm joined today by internationally acclaimed writer Natalie Goldberg, who is the author of 10 books, including the groundbreaking Writing Down the Bones, which 20 years ago ignited a creative revolution in writing practices throughout the country. She's also an accomplished painter, exhibiting her lively watercolors at Ernesto Mayan's gallery in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For over 30 years, she's been a beloved speaker and teacher, sharing her method of writing as spiritual practice. Her latest collaboration has been with filmmaker Mary Fite on their soon-to-be-released film, Tangled Up in Bob, about the life and art of Bob Dylan. Natalie Goldberg, welcome to Conscious Creating.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You may not know this, and some of my listeners may not know this, but I do a lot of research to prepare for the conversations that we do with one another each week, and I guess it's the actor's approach of reading and wanting to sort of inhabit the heart and mind of a character. And while I don't play you, I want to make a connection with you. And I want to be respectful of you and know what it is you've been doing with your life. And so I have spent a lot of time inhabiting your life lately. And I thought that it might be fun, if you're in the mood, to do this a little differently. First, I need you to sort of define these terms that you write about, monkey mind and wild mind, for the listeners, and then maybe we could play a game with this conversation.
Okay.
What is monkey mind?
Monkey mind is that voice in us. You can call it also the critic or the editor, the thing that is always holding us back. I can't do it. I'm scared. It's that constant commentary. No matter what we're doing, you know, of course we know it in writing. I can't do it. I'm no good. This is boring. Who do you think you are trying to be a writer, et cetera, et cetera. But we really have it as a constant commentator in our life as we go through our lives, you know, trying to hold us in and kind of control us.
And then wild mind.
Wild mind is really when you step out of the... I explain it in my second book, Wild Mind. I use the example of, look at the sky in Ohio. You know, a big sky on a summer day. And then get on a ladder and put a dot in the middle of the sky. And we usually just stay in that little dot, monkey mind. I can't do this, I don't like this, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, there's the whole sky. There's our whole mind and heart and body that's right here and capable of so much more. And not only that, it's connected to everything else. So when you write, you can pull in much more than your small mind. You can pull in horses and skies and oceans. You know, use the energy of the world. But we often get stuck on monkey mind. And wild mind is really, you know, the real nature of our mind and of our life is big and interconnected with all other beings and all other things. Now, the tricky thing is, if you go further, Wild Mind was my second book, if you read Thunder and Lightning, which I don't remember what number book it is.
I think it's number four.
Yeah. I became aware that actually monkey mind and wild mind are in cahoots. For instance, in writing, monkey mind is testing you. Are you willing to go where you need to go?
Mm-hmm.
Are you willing to carry the responsibility and the love of the true jewels of your heart? And so monkey mind doesn't let you go there so quickly. It, in a way, tests your mettle, and you have to keep standing up to it. So it's a different way of seeing it.
Would you say that the ego controls the monkey mind, and maybe the superego, of course, to use Jungian terms, might be more in the realm of the wild mind? Or could we do that?
Well, I think really ego and monkey mind are sort of the same.
That's what I was thinking, too.
It's way trying to make you solid and permanent in the truth of impermanence.
So you're not trying to say that having monkey mind or being a monkey mind is necessarily a bad thing. It's just that when you're creating and, I mean, would you want to live in wild mind all the time?
Well,
would that be a goal?
No, there's a relationship because mm-hmm. we're human beings on this earth. There's a relationship. And, you know, everyone has monkey mind. I want to say that because people have this idea that, well, if I had really supportive parents and a really nice teachers, et cetera, I wouldn't have it. It's an aid to being a human being. I think it began originally as a survival. You know, if you just listen to wild mind when you're a caveman or woman, you might have died.
Well, right. And maybe when we're adolescents, we listen to wild mind more in some ways.
Yes.
And then we get into trouble.
Yeah.
Well, with this as a basis, and I hope it fits, because this is just something I came up with a couple of minutes ago. My monkey mind prepared an interview, and then I thought, you know, I don't want to do that. I want us to really explore. So I want the listeners tonight to listen to your story and know about your work, but also get inside your head a little bit, if that's okay. And so, you know the game that you play sometimes, the I Remember game?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Where you ask people or they ask you to give you a memory of fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought maybe we'd talk about your life and your work and then occasionally insert I Remember and then let you go.
Okay.
Are you open to that? Good.
Yeah, let's try it.
Let's try it and see how it works.
Okay.
You know, we share...
I say one thing? Actually, I think one of the best things out of it, if you give me an I Remember, the listeners might hear how ordinary my mind is.
You go.
Yeah, that it's not, you know, always fine-tuned to writing a book. You know, you might give me something, and I might fall flat on my face. That's okay.
And you're brave, and you can do that. And what I'll do for you is when it's pertinent, I'll give you a memory of the same thing. You can ask me, okay?
Yeah.
If you want to. And then, because part of this for me is as I was reading about you as an artist and as a person, I began to see that we shared a lot of themes in our lives, and one of the themes that's been very important to me that I see running through your life and art is the theme of coming home, homecoming. And so I thought it would also be nice to sort of play with this theme as we examine the intersection of those, you know, personal and professional moments in your life. So let's start. Where were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
No, I can't tell that from your accent. I just need to let the listeners know when Natalie called me about this interview for the first time, she called me on my cell phone and she said, "Hello, Sarah, it's Natalie." I know where she's from. And you probably thought the same thing about me from the South.
Yeah, well, I heard your Southern accent, but you can imagine I left New York 40 years ago.
That's unimaginable. That's a long time.
You can imagine how thick it was.
It's deep in your bones.
Yeah.
So, and then your parents were children of immigrants.
Yes, they're first generation Jews in New York. They were from Poland and Russia.
Right. And then pretty quickly you moved to Farmington, the suburbs.
Farmingdale. Yeah, we lived in Brooklyn, I think, for the first 5 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Farmingdale, Long Island, which is on the Suffolk-Nassau border.
Mm. What did your father do for a living?
My father owned a bar. Kind of tough local bar in Farmingdale, where I think he'd open at 7 and sneak in some of the drunks. you know, to have early whiskey.
And he wore a white apron, one of those old-fashioned guys.
Yes, yes. How do you know all this?
Ooh, I'll never tell.
I'm impressed.
I'll never tell.
How?
So give me a memory of your father in the bar.
Okay.
I know that's specific, and you don't usually do that, but...
Yeah, well, I want to say first that the memory is that I rarely went to the bar because they didn't think it was the proper place for young ladies.
Good Jewish girl.
But when I did go, I remember that there were Wise potato chips on a rack, that there was a Seagram sign spinning, and that I'd climb up on a high stool, and it was an oak bar. And my father did have an apron on. And he'd give me a Coca-Cola with a maraschino cherry in it. And I could see in his office, he had a tiny little office which really just had a black phone. But over the phone hung a plaster little cast of my handprint, which I had made in kindergarten.
Wonderful memory. You describe yourself as a lonely sort of isolated nerd when you were in high school.
Yes.
And that's from Long Quiet Highway, Waking Up in America, published in 1993. And you write, "My desolation was that no one knew me and I did not know myself. My family's life was my life. I knew nothing else."
Yes.
Give me a memory of adolescence.
A memory of adolescence, okay. I'm walking down the hallway, a gray hallway in the Farmingdale High School, wearing a blue wool cardigan and a pleated wool skirt and Oxfords and white socks, carrying a suitcase, school bag, and having my hair pinned back, straight back in a barrette. And going to the next class.
I'm going to give you a memory.
Okay.
I remember sitting on a smooth pine bench with a skirt that was a pleated plaid skirt 5 or 6 inches above my knees and running my hands down onto my legs and feeling my thighs and squeezing them and feeling fat.
Uh-huh.
And then also the feeling of little dry pin-like bumps on the thighs from dry skin and feeling inadequate and not smooth and beautiful.
I bet a lot of people have that memory, women especially.
I bet they do. And then ironically, making $150 an hour with a 2-hour minimum to model when I was older. So, you know, who the hell knows what's going to happen, right?
Uh-huh.
If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating, this is your host, Sarah Robinson, talking with prolific writer and painter, Natalie Goldberg, who is the author of Writing Down the Bones, The Great Failure, and a new film called Tangled Up in Bob. So, you were the first in your family to attend college, and would you leave at 17 to go to George Washington University?
Yeah, I was 18.
18?
Yeah.
Was D.C. a lot different from Farmingdale?
Yes. The only other city I'd ever been to or knew was New York City, which we would go into once in a while, very once in a while. And Washington, I thought cities meant high rises, you know, and big buildings. And Washington, D.C. was very pretty, actually, and very different.
Mm-hmm. And you encountered some interesting people from different backgrounds. Give me a memory of the Southern girl. The Southern girl who made you fried chicken?
Oh, from Texas.
And with honey?
Yes, Alex. Alex was someone who came from Texas, and her father's name was Comer. would make me fried chicken, and she also taught me to stuff green peppers with rice and chopped meat, is my memory, and she smoked a lot. She knew about politics, but I always remember her father's name was Comer.
K-O-M-E-R.
No, C-O-M-E-R.
C-O-M-E-R. Interesting.
Yes.
And then after college, you followed your boyfriend to Taos?
No. It's quite complicated. I followed a boyfriend to Detroit, where he was working. So we lived in Detroit for a year.
That's right.
And then we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we started a natural foods restaurant called Naked Lunch after William Burroughs' book. And that's actually where I really, I think, started opening up, because I suddenly wasn't in school. And in the morning, if I wanted to, I could make muffins with peanut butter and blueberries, and nobody could say I was wrong. I couldn't get an F.
You didn't have white bread with the crust cut off with cottage cheese on top.
Yeah. I could do whatever I wanted,
right.
And there was no grade. So I began to trust my own, and have a confidence in my own experience. And eventually that led to writing, where I began to trust that.
And when were you in Taos for the first time, when you were teaching the sixth grade?
Oh, okay. I was teaching the sixth grade. You know, my locations are kind of mixed up. I was in Albuquerque.
You've been in a lot of places.
Yeah. I was in Albuquerque teaching sixth grade after I finished Naked Lunch, the restaurant. I was teaching a cooking class at the Y in Ann Arbor, and I realized I really liked to teach, so I went back and got a teaching certificate.
Right.
And then I moved to Albuquerque, and my first teaching job was sixth graders in the Northwest Valley in Albuquerque.
It's mostly Mexican and American Indian students? Or?
Yeah, Hispanic. And Native Americans.
And you write that it was in this unlikely setting that you experienced an awakening.
Yeah.
Give me a memory of that.
Well,
that's the most interesting story I've ever heard.
Well, I was standing in front of a class and, you know, teaching, and the kids were wild because I took over for a teacher who dropped out, evidently with the excuse that she was going to go back for a PhD. But what I found out was she'd been teaching for 12 years, and this class was so uncontrollable that she threw up her hands. So here I was so naive, and so I just didn't know anything, and I really didn't know a lot about New Mexico or Albuquerque. And the kids were just zipping around the classroom. I couldn't get them to sit in their seats. And this was about the sixth week of teaching there. And I had a big, we had big windows, and out the window you could see the Sandia Mountains. And suddenly, as the kids were zipping around, I'm trying to get control of them, I look out the window, and I just experienced this huge opening in my heart where I was very naive before that. I don't know what it was, but I just saw myself wandering in autumn fields, and I felt like this, meaning what was right in front of me, didn't have a lot of meaning. Now, it didn't mean that the kids didn't matter and the school didn't, but I think in a very large way that I don't know, actually.
Well, you called it the Garden of Eden.
It was like I experienced the Garden of Eden inside my chest. And I stopped trying to control the kids.
What did you feel in your body at that moment?
I just remember I had a vision.
So it was more of a vision than a sensation.
Yeah, more a vision of me wandering in autumn fields. And I write about all this in Long Quiet Highway.
Right.
But, afterwards, for like 2 weeks afterwards, I was very uptight. It was very scary to have such an opening. And I'd wake up in the middle of the night and just stare for hours. And I didn't know what was happening to me, and it was very scary, actually.
Did you ever wonder if you were going mad?
I didn't think about going mad. I was just scared. I didn't feel like I was going mad. I was just scared.
And when you talked to your friends about this, what was the response?
Well, my friends, it scared them. Mm-hmm. I had very intellectual friends. I had just gotten a master's degree in philosophy in the great books in Santa Fe. And my friends were really intellectual, very smart. We were all atheists. And suddenly, I was having this experience of emptiness. And my friends were very nervous about it. They didn't want to hear, and they didn't know how to relate to me.
And they couldn't use their monkey mind on it, could they?
Well, I'm sure their monkey mind started spinning.
But you couldn't explain it. And
yes.
So they became very critical because it was scary.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've experienced that reaction. And so you quit your job and talk about jumping, and the net will appear, to use a cliche. I mean, you jumped and went, heard about the Llama Foundation. And
Llama Foundation up in San Cristobal, New Mexico, which was 17 miles north of Taos. And, you know, I started meditating. They taught me to meditate. And really the whole world opened for me then. I think I joined the hippie generation.
Did you feel like a hippie at the time? Did you really identify with that?
Not really. Not really. But I really loved being in nature. And I loved meditating. And, it was gorgeous. And all these extraordinary teachers came through that I met. That I'd had no idea about before. Eastern teachers from the East.
Right. And that was new in America, really.
Yeah.
A new thing.
Just beginning, yeah.
And I love the story. I was really struck by the woman who was approaching you as you were coming down the road to enter the Llama Foundation for the first time. She had a white robe on, and you were very vulnerable and cracked open and told her what had happened to you. And what did she say to you?
Yeah, she said, I told her, the Garden of Eden, I feel so naive now saying that, the Garden of Eden opened in my chest. And she didn't think I was crazy. She looked at me and said, well, you need to learn a practice to water that garden.
Love that. And that's exactly what you did, Natalie.
Yes, I did it, and I never turned from it.
You never did. And I was so moved by that because some of us, and I'm one of them, vacillate on our practice.
Mm-hmm.
Or not sure, use our monkey mind on it too much. You know, is this the right practice for me? And you have had the practice of writing and the practice of Zen meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel more connected with one than the other now?
See, that's monkey mind, too.
Just, okay,
you
good.
Know what it really
correct
is?
Me.
That's what, you know, oh, is this better? What should I be doing? You know, we drive ourselves
well,
crazy.
Well, yeah, teach me about that.
Yeah, so what I just do is they all come from the same source. So sometimes I'm writing.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I'm meditating. Sometimes I'm painting. Sometimes I'm cutting carrots.
Right.
It's all from the same source. That's when we get ourselves crazy, when we divide things and make things separate. And, you know, we try to control them. I am going to do this now.
Exactly.
Now, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't make some effort. And especially when you first start a practice, you do need effort, to show up, keep showing up. But don't add more problems by, adding your monkey mind and, commenting and criticizing. Just shut up and show up.
Right. And you did that for a long time, and we're getting to that point where let me just say to the listeners, if you've just joined us on Conscious Creating, this is Sarah Robinson talking with writer and painter Natalie Goldberg, author of Writing Down the Bones and The Great Failure and Tangled Up in Bob, her latest film. So then you took another unexpected path eventually to Minneapolis. It sounds like you followed men around. Was this one man that you followed around or
no,
several?
No, it does sound like I followed men around, doesn't it?
I mean, I hope you don't mind me making that observation.
No, I never thought of that. But I moved to Taos on my own. You know, so I did move places on my
Ta-da.
Own. Yeah, but I did move to Detroit for a man,
mm-hmm.
and I moved. Then I fell in love with someone that I was with in Taos that I lived with, and we decided together that he was going to go and work for his father in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and so I went there to be with him. But it is true, you know, it's funny, I followed these men, but it ended up, it wasn't about the men.
No.
I found other things there.
It's never about anyone, is it?
Yeah, no, it's just, it was the next thing to do.
And you experienced loneliness in Minnesota until you found your way to the Zen Center.
Yeah.
And who was Katagiri Roshi?
He was a Japanese Zen master that was living in a house that was a Zendo on Lake Calhoun in Minneapolis. And I started studying with him.
Give me a memory of Roshi.
Well, a bald head, quite muscular, very alive. He would wear black robes. He'd meditate every morning at 5 a.m., whether we showed up or not, he was going to show up. And he told me that our practice is to give kind consideration to all sentient beings every moment, forever. Big, huh?
Big. Except in let's see, which book was it? Oh, The Great Failure. Where I love this. You say, I can sit and pray and meditate for sentient beings everywhere, but that doesn't mean I can't roll my eyes at them.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about your father.
Uh-huh.
And I love that. We can get to that at some point, too. But so you learned a lot.
Yeah, I did. I really learned a lot from him, and I feel a lot of gratitude. And I think I grew up, too. As I write in The Great Failure was, you know, he was wonderful. I practiced with him for 12 years. And when he died, it came out 6 years later that he'd been sleeping with students. I had no idea. So I kind of grew up. I had to write that book, The Great Failure, to continue his story.
Right.
I'd written The Great Long Quiet Highway, which is everyone's favorite book of mine.
Right.
And all of that is still true in
yes.
Long Quiet Highway. But I had additional information, and I had to keep the story alive.
Well, and as a reader, I'd like to share the feedback that having read the two books within a few days of one another, you peeled more layers, I think, with the second book. The Great Failure for me was even more self-revelatory and honest. Of course, you were older and had been through more as well.
Yeah, thank you. That makes me happy.
I really appreciated it, and it inspired me as a writer to go deeper. I think I mentioned that in one of our correspondents, that it's okay to tell the truth.
Yeah.
It's okay to let it go.
And it's hard. It's hard. That was not an easy book for me to read, and it wasn't received well in the Zen community. But finally, I have to know where I stand. I can't be tossed away if somebody doesn't like my stuff. I have to write what I have to write.
Well, let me tell you what it did for me as well.
Okay.
One of the things I struggle with, and particularly in this job, talking with a lot of people whom others consider gurus, in whatever field. They put them up on a pedestal and consider them gurus. And then I, in my research, will find things that are off-putting and sound like, you know, the person is disingenuous or whatever, and I have to allow myself to pull back and not judge and to just say, here's a human being. And initially when I would find conflicting information about individuals, I would feel fear and, oh no, I can't talk to this person, or I can't, what if these things are true? What if they espouse this sort of ideology and are just making money, you know, off of spirituality, and are not living their, walking their talk? And then I came, after, particularly after reading your book, I came to the conclusion that, you know, people are good and bad. People are human. People have, and not even good and bad, but people get projected on by others. And it is not fair for that human being to have all of the light taken away from them just because they do things that I don't approve of or society doesn't approve of.
Yes, I think that's true, but I think it's also important that these people get confronted or they deal with it, because
it
often harms other people.
I think you're right.
Yeah, but I never stopped loving Katagiri. And that the great failure was really about the two most important men in my life, my father and my Zen teacher. I never stopped loving them, even though I looked at how I was disappointed and betrayed. But it takes a lot of work to open your arms that big and not make things black and white. We get scared and want to make it black and white. But really, we all live in that gray area.
Well, and perhaps we have not sexually abused or physically abused or been inappropriate in that way with others, but I think we could say that we've wronged others and betrayed others.
Yes.
And
yes.
So I have to look at myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to dismiss myself because I have made poor decisions and poor choices. But I thought it was a beautiful counterpoint in the great failure between the father, the two fathers, the teacher and the biological father. And you portrayed their beauty and their love and their joy for living. I mean, I felt like I loved both those men from your description.
Oh, Sarah, this is so wonderful to hear you say.
Really? I thought perhaps you'd already heard this.
No, you know, people kind of backed away from that.
Really?
Scary for me.
Oh, it was so meaningful for me. Because I've had some similar experiences with my father, very much, to let the listeners know, the father, Natalie's father, emotionally incested her. And would you call it that?
Yeah, I think I was always terrified of him.
And my father emotionally incested me. And my parents were divorced, and my father took custody because he had money. And I became the wife.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to deal with that. I had to deal with him. I didn't talk with him for 8 years. This isn't an interview about me, but I think sharing these things is good, because what I can say today is much like what you can say, Natalie. My father was a brilliant man. He was fun. He was handsome. He was educated and inspired me. And I'm not going to say that all of those things didn't happen just because he made some really poor choices in his behavior towards me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not, we always want a resolution. You know, this is what it is. But life isn't like that.
It is not.
And I think the more you write, you realize that, you know, that you can't nab anything. You know, you can ask me, I remember one day, and I'll remember something completely different another day.
Right. Here's a question I had for you about that experience of writing The Great Failure. I wrote Snowbound, my first play, as a sort of autobiographical catharsis in dealing with this. And, I dealt with it with comedy because it was easier for me. Maybe I need to go back and deal with it the way you did, quite honestly. But did you feel it was a cathartic experience?
No.
You wouldn't describe it that way.
People want me to say that.
Okay.
But the truth is, it was just scary. Now, I'm not cathartic. I feel I grew up with it.
Well, okay, let me not use that word.
Yeah.
Were you able to learn through the process and have your feelings and visions and ideas about these men, did they transform through the process of writing the book? Or had you already formulated everything before you started writing?
Well, no. No.
Well, tell me.
It was very scary to write what I was writing.
So you sat down and you were in fear.
Acknowledgments. I wrote, and I didn't write, I was living in Taos then, I didn't write in Taos at all. I acknowledged cafes
right. All
over the country, or I would write in airports, almost like I couldn't believe I was saying this stuff.
Oh.
So it was kind of scary. My writer self is often way ahead of Natalie, the human being. She's fearless, and she just goes ahead.
Yes,
and the rest of me always has to catch up. So in a way, writing is my true practice because it takes me places that I'd rather not go. And, so it's really a practice for me. It takes me to the scary places I don't want to go. Now, it doesn't mean I didn't know these things, but to write about them is somehow to stand up with them.
You're right. That's it. And I would encourage, as I know you do, other people, whether you publish it or not, to write about it, if you can,
whatever
it is. And the thing I loved, another thing I loved about The Great Failure was there's so many books on incest. You named one that was the big sort of, it started a movement.
The Courage to Heal.
The Courage to Heal, which of course, I've read and many have. And I think it has a wonderful place. What I like about your book is you're not wallowing in the problem.
Yes.
I think you are coming into a whole solution. And I wonder if perhaps it was the imperfection of the men and your husband, your father, your teacher, that led you in some way to an experience of greater wholeness?
Well,
because that's the animus.
I think what I did was I was willing to show a personal experience. But people need to understand that I probably wallowed for years. I wouldn't say wallowed. I got to this kind of clarity. I wanted to show a book that had equanimity.
Right.
But I had to come to that place. And you don't come to it falsely.
Absolutely.
So you're seeing a book that I wrote probably, minimum 15 years after I'd done all this work with my father.
And that is an important point.
Yes,
and I don't want to give the impression that people shouldn't feel their pain and identify it and grieve it and work through it. But I do like to see pictures of people having worked through it.
Yeah, we did.
I wanted
to show that. Now, that doesn't mean it still doesn't affect my life. You're not saved ever. Those patterns are still in me. But I wanted to show a book where I'd gone to another place, that you can go over, something else. At least give that as a vision.
Well, you did it.
Thank you.
You did it for me deeply.
Thank you very much.
I'm extremely grateful.
Did you get the paperback edition? Because that has an essay in the back, I wrote the book.
I have both, and yes, I did read that.
Oh, good, good.
Thank you. If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating, this is your host, Sarah Robinson, talking with writer, painter, Natalie Goldberg, author of Writing Down the Bones. Now, a lot of people don't know you're a painter, but you've actually been painting as long as you've been writing.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I noticed, I've only seen images of your paintings. I can't wait to see them in person, but I noticed a real contrast in the styles of your writing and painting. For me, your writing, you know, is detailed and specific and masterfully executed, and would lead me to expect paintings that would be perhaps more in a realistic genre.
Uh-huh.
But then your painting is just wild and primitive and has a sort of childlike quality to it. Would you agree with this? And if so, to what would you attribute that?
Well, it is actually detailed in that I sit with the pen that I actually write with.
Yeah.
I sit in front of something and I draw it.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on I color it in.
Okay.
But writing is my real practice. Can I say this? My ass is on the line with writing. Painting is my darling pleasure.
Aww.
And so another part of me comes out and is very playful. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not playful sometimes with my writing, and I think even The Great Failure has some very funny things in it. But with painting, I just seem to paint happiness.
Hmm.
Except for the portraits of my father.
Of your father, sure.
Which you see in Wild Mon... No, what is it? Living
Color. No, Living Color.
Living Color, Rider Paints Her World.
Rider Paints Her World.
There's a
beautiful
chapter
book
about my father, yeah. And there, it's a deeper level I reach with painting. But it's my darling pleasure.
I love that. Darling pleasure. And they make me happy, your paintings.
Yeah, they make me happy, too.
And I was wondering, and perhaps you wrote about this, I hope I'm not stealing your idea, but I can't remember, but maybe it was something I wrote in the margin, and that was that you seem to be operating as a real professional when you're a writer, and you seem to be operating almost like a child as a painter. And I'm not saying they're not wonderful paintings.
No,
but I'm just saying I feel a child in those paintings.
No,
and I feel a grown-up that's trying to teach me something and teach me beautifully in your writing.
Uh-huh. Yes, no, I think that's true. I'm a complete professional in my writing, and my painting is... I just have fun. I mean, I take it seriously and I work on it, but I don't, I only do it after I've done my writing. It's kind of like candy.
Are you selling your paintings?
Oh, yeah, my paintings sell very well.
Wow.
Actually, all the paintings in Living Color are sold.
I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw the book Top of My Lungs.
Yes.
Which is my paintings and my poems.
Right, I did.
And then there's another book called Essential Writer's Notebook, which has my paintings in it, too.
That's right.
And
you can go on Natalie's website, which is www.nataliegoldberg.com, and view her gallery there.
Yes, and also, now this was my secret, because it was my darling secret till 1997 when I came out with Living Color. Before that, people didn't really know I painted.
You were a closet painter.
Except there was a secret I hinted. Wild Mind, which came out in 1990, the cover painting is my painting.
Ah.
It was a cafe that I wrote in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Yeah.
And if you study a book, when I get a book, I study it.
Oh, I do too. I love books.
Yeah. In the inside copyright page, it says that it's a painting by me. But no one ever noticed it or said it to me. They might have noticed it, but no one had ever acknowledged it to me.
I didn't read that book until I started, you know, getting
no,
ready
it's
to talk
fine.
To you.
I'm not,
so,
but, you
no, until I started getting ready to talk to you. But I did recognize it as your work, I have to say.
Uh-huh.
Because I had read, you know, I had seen
my
your
other
work.
Yes. Yeah.
And you do have an original style, I think.
It's such a pleasure. I love to go to museums. I love to go to galleries. I love to look at people's paintings. It's just free for me.
So give me a memory of the color blue.
I remember that I had just moved to Santa Fe in 1984 when I came back from Minnesota, and I was waiting to move into a house, and the house wasn't ready for me. So I took a walk with my pad, my drawing pad, and I found an old adobe on Old Santa Fe Trail, and I sat down on the curb, and I drew it. Now, adobe, if you know, is made of mud, and it's usually brown. Mm-hmm. And when I took my paints to it, I painted it blue instead of brown.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, seeing it as blue gives you the deeper feeling of brown. I know that sounds absurd, but sometimes when you say it's brown and paint it brown, you don't feel the aliveness of it. You know, if you say the trees are green and the sky is blue and your car is red, mm-hmm. it just doesn't, you know, it's fun to turn things upside down.
You know,
the sky is pink, the trees are red, mm-hmm. you know.
That's my daughter, Sarah Claire, who is will be 17 next month, is an IB International Baccalaureate Art student. And she wants to be a visual artist and was criticized last year by a teacher, who I probably shouldn't say this on the air, who gave them an assignment of doing a self-portrait, and she used much different colors, very vibrant colors, the kind that you use, and thick swabs of paint on the face. To indicate emotion and feeling. I thought it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. She was graded down on it because the teacher didn't understand what she was trying to do. And she said, but you have to understand that these colors are more me than the colors I see when I look in the mirror.
Oh, good for her.
And she fought for it. And
good for her.
So I'm sending her I'm going to try to send her to Pat Allen, one of my guests, who said she would help her out. You know, I want to keep that wildness and let that grow and not be put down by the teachers in the world who don't appreciate it.
Oh, show her Living Color.
Show her. She studied your work. She loves it.
Oh, great.
She loves it. She said, Mom, when can we go visit Natalie and see her work?
Oh.
My kids are so funny. They think this is great with all these artists that we talk to.
Oh, well, that's great.
So, well, your latest project, we have to talk about that, is an exploration of the life and work of Bob Dylan in film called Tangled Up in Bob. And when I saw film clips, which everyone can see on Natalie's website at www.nataliegoldberg.com, I already knew about you and your life from your writing, and also knew you'd always been a fan of Bob Dylan.
Yes, I've always been crazy about Bob Dylan.
So give me a memory of Bob Dylan.
Oh, well, I don't know Bob Dylan, but
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah, but your memory, you know.
Yeah, I remember driving back from Minnesota early 2000
mm-hmm.
and playing from his one of his later albums, Time Out of Mind, the song, Gotta Get to Heaven Before They Close the Door. And I must have played that 1,000 times driving from Minnesota to New Mexico. I love playing a song over and over and over again till it just goes into my body.
I do too. I thought there was something wrong with me, but
maybe not. I think it's no.
If Natalie Goldberg does it, that's okay. So you remember that?
Yeah. And it was really fun because, you know, sometimes I can't drive with other people because when I drive with other people, you know, you have to listen to a whole album. And they'll have to be normal, right? To hear a song over and over.
Well, you know, it was really interesting on these film clips, and I can't wait to see the movie, to watch you travel in Bob's footsteps But in a way, I felt like you were searching for your own home.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, I wonder if the origin of the tangled up part of the title might be, you know, what is that? Tangled up in Natalie, tangled up in Bob. I mean, what?
Yes.
I mean, he's a Jewish boy from the Midwest, and
yeah. Well, originally the idea of the tangled up in Bob were all these people who are tangled up in Bob, not in a bad way, but we go to his home of Hibbing, Minnesota, where he was brought up, a very small town on the Iron Range in northern Minnesota. Once you land in Minnesota, you have to drive 4 hours north. That's how remote it was.
Hmm.
And I'm very interested in where artists come from.
Oh, me too.
Where writers come from, who they are, what affected them, how did we become who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Dylan, who I'm crazy about, I wanted to see where he came from and explore that. And eventually, of course, it took me not only to me, but I think, he became human for me.
Right.
You know, he was, I think of him as the Shakespeare of our time. Yes, he's the Shakespeare of our time, and also he had a home and a family, and he brushes his teeth in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So he became very human for me, and I just wanted to see where he came from.
Did you ever meet him?
No, you know, he's pretty much of a hermit in some ways. His people know we did the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was so strange last night. I never watch television unless a friend is on or I was on. But one of my little rituals to anesthetize myself is to just flip through some channels on the TV right before I go to sleep. It's very strange. You play music 1,000 times. That's what I do. So I was flipping through last night, and I saw on PBS a documentary on Bob Dylan.
Oh.
And I had to watch it.
Was it the Martin Scorsese?
I was too sleepy to watch it until the end to find out, and they never announced it.
Uh-huh.
But he was in it. Dylan was in it. And they interviewed lots and lots of people about the whole Beat generation and the folk music and Greenwich Village in the early 60s.
Oh, and with Joan Baez in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's Martin Scorsese's film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, documentary.
It was beautifully done.
Yeah, it was well done.
I loved Bob Dylan in it. I really thought he was great. Well, I have to give you a memory of Bob Dylan.
Okay.
So ask me to give you a memory.
Okay. Give me a memory of Bob Dylan.
Okay. It's 1998, and my children, who are 10 and 6, are with me and my husband in Asheville, North Carolina, on holiday. And we're walking down, the main street and see a theater at night. You can just go around Asheville, just walk around, and they have open doors with music. Different music, you know, folk, neo-folk, whatever. So then in this big theater, there's Bob Dylan on the marquee, and it's really crowded, and my 10-year-old really wants to go to the concert, and we couldn't get tickets, and we couldn't get them in because there was drinking inside. So the bouncer is standing there opening the door, letting people in, and he sees that my children really want to hear Dylan, and my husband had heard him back in the early 70s, and we just start chatting. Well, the bouncer keeps the door open so my children can stand out there and hear it.
Uh-huh.
And he's singing all of his great songs, and finally this you know, neo-hippie walks by, and he says, looks at my kids and says, "Man, you don't know how cool your parents are to let you stand here and listen to this shit." That's my Bob Dylan memory.
Oh, great.
And I thought, I hope they remember that when they get to be teenagers. So it was a wonderful experience, then, all in all, making a film. Was it different, or...
Yes, it was wonderful. Of course, it was wonderful because I wasn't the filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
so I wasn't responsible for things as much. But it was wonderful to collaborate and not to be alone. Sometimes writing is very lonely.
It is.
You know, and you have to go off by yourself. And suddenly here I was, you know, with other people, traveling with, you know, photographers and, you know, video people. And it was just so much fun.
Yeah, you look like you were having fun on the bus particularly.
Yeah, it was the best. It was just so much fun. I just can't say. It was just a thrill.
Whose idea was it? Were you approached to do it?
Yes, Mary Fite, the filmmaker, approached me when she heard that I was, you know, crazy about Bob Dylan.
That is really an interesting story. And, yes, film is very collaborative, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I have worked as an actor in film and hanging out on the set, waiting between takes for setups. And there's a lot of sitting. A lot of people don't know that.
Yes, yeah. But it was also, it was so nice. I mean, it was just a wonderful experience and also, you know, it used your mind in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, after writing 10 books, I really am concentrated in a certain direction.
Did you do a lot of actual writing of the film?
No.
Because it's not scripted.
No, it's not scripted.
Tell the listeners about it, if you will, please.
Pardon?
Share with the listeners a little bit about the format of it, because I haven't seen the whole thing.
Oh, okay. Well, she took 100 hours of film. It's a documentary. And it was reduced to 1 hour. And so there's a lot of editing in it. And through it, she found a story of me. And it's really me taking you through exploring Bob Dylan, trying to find out about Bob Dylan's childhood.
So
we stay pretty much in Minnesota, mm-hmm. in Hibbing. We do go down to Shreveport, Louisiana.
Why?
Because he listened to Black R&R late at night on the radio. He could pick it up on AM radio when he was about 16. And we also go to Princeton to interview Sean Wilentz, who knows a lot about Bob Dylan. And
right.
I think when he was a kid, he went to Dylan concerts. So we pull in different people, but we mostly stay in his hometown.
And this film will be made available on your website.
Yeah, and it'll be available in, I think in about a month or so, you can all get the DVD. But also, we're showing it in New York City on November 19th.
Oh, that's my husband's birthday.
Yeah, at the Lighthouse.
The Lighthouse.
And it's through the New York Open Center. So if anybody is out there and hears this, please come.
Yes, definitely. Or make a special trip and have fun. Do some Christmas shopping in New York or whatever it is you do. So you continue to teach and write and paint and love. What's next for you?
Well, I'm working on a new book right now. It's called Old Friend from Far Away, and it's about writing memoir, and it's for Simon & Schuster,
mm-hmm.
and it's due May 1st, mm-hmm. so I have to kind of kick ass right now.
Okay. Natalie Goldberg, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you very much. This was just a pleasure.
Oh, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I hope we'll be able to continue this dialogue in the future.
Yes, thank you very much.
I encourage our listeners to learn more about Natalie's work and her life by visiting her website at www.nataliegoldberg.com. Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating, the Art of Transformation. We hope you'll visit our website at www.consciouscreating.net to learn more about the show, my art, and to give us your thoughts on what you heard. Conscious Creating is made possible through my collaboration with Billy Fallon and the terrific sound engineers at Out of Sync Productions. This is your host, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a fruitful week of Conscious Creating.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.